www.bubbledub.org. Let's do it again. Like bubba da ba doom boom
boom bubba da ba doom ba doom. This is Vince Wilburn Jr., host of Evolution of the Groove, multi-genre progressive music, culture, and conversation. Check us out at our new time, Sundays at 5 on 90.7 KPFK and KPFK.org. Multi-genre, progressive music, culture, and conversation. Evolution of the Groove with me, Vince Wilburn Jr., now, Sundays at 5. Take a deep dive into No Boundaries, No Limits.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
Don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be, a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. And if you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power.
Hotep, this is Femi, welcoming you to the liberated zone of freedom now. Watch out, a Pan-Africanist, internationalist, world affairs program with a revolutionary spirited music mix. Freedom Now stands in solidarity with all oppressed and indigenous peoples worldwide, bringing you an anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist hour devoid of the Eurocentrism, NATO, and their all lies point of view, regularly broadcasted in mainstream propaganda media. So we thank you, the listeners, in particular all who donated for our recent fund drive. To support listener-sponsored radio commercial-free, visit kpfk.org if you would like to donate and continue to support Freedom Now. Premiums are listed on the website. Stay tuned for our agenda here on Freedom Now. As always, we stand ready for revolution. Forward.
Hotep, this is Sister Thage with Freedom Now's agenda for the week of August 29, 2020. First, we'd like to give our condolences to the family of Chadwick Boseman as he transitioned to the ancestor world yesterday. As an actor, he focused on roles of Africans and historical figures, most notably T'Challa from Black Panther, Jackie Robinson, James Brown, Thurgood Marshall, and more. We commence today's program with our sister, Luyanda Kuboka, and the African Drumbeat Historical Calendar. Then, we are joined by our sister, Pambana Bassett, member of the Jamaica Peace Council, and our brother, Mose Hyde, who is the president of the Christian Workers Union in Belize, where they join us to discuss what is happening with the stevedores, which are the dock workers, and here to discuss their ongoing struggles and recent victory with their three-year collective bargaining agreement. Then, our brother General Jeff, community activist and organizer in Skid Row, gives us our weekly update on what is happening right here in Los Angeles, America's homeless capital. We close out with our co-producer, prolific author, radical historian, and professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, Dr. Gerald Horn, here with his weekly geopolitical analysis discussing systemic racism and the UN, China, this past week's Republican National Convention, Kenosha, Wisconsin, warmonger Mike Pompeo in regards to his recent visits to Jerusalem and Sudan. Our music clip mix includes MLK, Zap Mama, Elise Gomez playing marimba, Jay Dilla, and As Freedom Now continues to highlight Los Angeles jazz musicians. This week we honor Don Cherry. So sit back, tell a friend, and as always, we stand ready for revolution.
No, I have not seen that the men in our I'm saying they are not here because of the crimes that they committed, but because of the color of their skin.
Thank you. Habarigani. This is Sister Luyanda with the African Drum Beat Historical Calendar for this Tuesday, August 28th, with
Yo-Yo
and Ati.
The purpose of this presentation is to put into context our present struggle against the war in Iraq, the war against racism, police brutality, sexism, economic exploitation, within a broad chronological perspective, as to gain strength by standing on the shoulders of our revolutionary ancestors. September 1st, 1961. The armed struggle for the liberation of Eritrea from the Ethiopian Empire begins. Ethiopia, an ancient empire, is composed of many kingdoms brought into the empire under the ancient leaders of Ethiopia. Eritrea revolted against the force of integration into Ethiopia. September 1st, 1892. Queen Kosia, an African woman Shiro, leads one of the many labor revolts in the present-day U.S. colony of St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. September 2nd, 1945. Under the leadership of Ho Chi Minh, Vietnam becomes independent after a long war against Japanese and French imperialism. September 2nd, 1917. Queen Lili Ukulani was the last of the Royal Hawaiian Monarch of a free Hawaii before U.S. colonization. She resisted the U.S. takeover, and on January 16, 1893, she was arrested and imprisoned by the U.S. Marines during the U.S. invasion to seize Hawaii. September 4, 1841. Preemption Act makes Western United States Native American land open to racist European settler colonialism without any regards or concern for their traditional 500,000-year presence, thus declaring Native Americans non-human. September 4, 1973. Salvador Allende, democratically elected Prime Minister of Chile, was overthrown by the CIA-backed military coup and was murdered by the U.S. henchman General Pinochet. American copper corporations dictated to the United States government that Prime Minister Allende must be murdered because he demanded better working conditions for the copper workers of Chile. September 4, 1895. Ching Yuhuang was born. Ching, a Chinese socialist and women's rights advocate, who emerged from the May 4th movement of 1915 to become the teacher and leader of the anti-foot binding campaign, where baby girls' feet were broken and wrapped to produce small feet, a symbol of beauty under feudal China. She was a leading member of the Chinese Communist Party in 1921, which defeated the Japanese, United States, and British combined efforts to colonize China. September 4, 1781. In California, El Pueblo de Nuestra Señora Reina de Los Angeles, later shortened to Los Angeles, was founded. September 4, 1957. Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus calls out the National Guard to bar African students from attending Little Rock High School, which was tax-supported by African residents of Arkansas. This has been the historical calendar on Freedom Now, KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, and streaming worldwide at www.kpfk.org. We would like to close out with a collective chant of solidarity with all of those in the listening audience who side with the oppressed, with the masses of humanity, with the environment, with the political spiritual message of Jesus, Allah, Jah, Buddha, or whatever we choose to call, and in the struggle of people over profits. We chant Amandla, and our response is Awetu, which means the power is ours. Amandla, Awetu. Amandla, Awetu. Amandla, Awetu.
We'd like to welcome back to Freedom Now our sister Pambana Bassett. She's a member of the Jamaica Peace Council, joining us to discuss Black Workers of the World and celebration of the Belize Union victory. Welcome back to Freedom Now.
Greetings. First, thank you so much, Sister Tage, for opening the space. Thank you to Freedom Now listeners in Los Angeles and across the world in this month of Black August, and always your accompaniment of Black liberation struggles is just fantastic.
Sister Pombana, just a few weeks ago, the Jamaica Peace Council, along with the Caribbean Peace Movement, Global African Congress, Caribbean Labor Solidarity, and the 13th June 1980 movement, penned a solidarity letter with the Christian Workers Union from Belize. And so, can you give us some background and expand on who are the CWU, the Christian Workers Union, and the situation happening at the ports in Belize?
So the Christian Workers Union is based in Belize City, and its union members are from Belize City and Belmopan, which is in Belize, in Central America and the Caribbean. There are many in the Belize diaspora in Los Angeles, hopefully tuning in, and they may know that the union has about 1,300 members, and they are across many different industries. So there are workers who are in the Statistical Institute of Belize, who are in NICH, the National Institute of Culture and History, Citrus Products of Belize, the Credit Union, Central Bank, Social Security Department, Belize City Council, their sanitation workers, and their stevedores, as well as office workers at the Port of Belize. And, you know, in this sense, it's a kind of dream union. An umbrella union. You know, many unionists dream of having, not being only one trade, but being able to create a united front across multiple trades. And the Christian Workers Union, you know, despite its name, is more like a union of a variety of different workers who've come together. And under the leadership of Evan Mose Hyde, they have in particular been working on building solidarity across their different trades, and also different class, you know, statuses in Belizean society, and different interests occasionally, and different labor needs, all working together to fight for dignified working conditions for Belize workers, particularly in the union, but generally. And the stevedores of the Christian Workers Union are a majority Black workers, and they have remained so for the history of dock workers or longshoremen in Belize, and are a critical part of Belize culture, both economy as well as Belize City in particular. They provide a heart for the working class communities of Belize City, as workers who, you know, make something that is very close to a living wage, but certainly under conditions that are precarious and that are often quite dangerous, and that are central for the movement of goods in and out of the country. And as your listeners know, you know, longshoremen, dock workers, stevedores have a long history of being engaged in stopping the economy to, you know, the movement of a capitalist economy to defend workers' rights, and then also, you know, being kind of at a center of transnational knowledge and exchange.
Sister Pombana, can you talk about the 3-year collective bargaining agreement and the current state of affairs happening at the ports in Belize?
So that explains why, as you mentioned, the fight of the stevedores is so important across the Caribbean, and why the Jamaica Peace Council, the Caribbean Peace Movement, and other articulations that are part of the global worker struggle, the Global African Congress, for example, have all joined in a call, the June 13th movement, folks from Trinidad and Tobago, from Barbados, Pan-Caribbean communities and workers in Canada, across the world, in Jamaica, in Belize, see the struggle of the stevedores who have just achieved this collective bargaining agreement after over 10 years of not having had one, as so tremendous. It comes out of many, many years of struggle and a really intensified battle against large multinationals with very conservative and hyper-capitalist interests, you know, that comes out of the privatization of the ports, something that happened across the Caribbean and the global south with the onslaught of the IMF and World Bank Structural Adjustment Program. And, you know, so the Cebadores, who are, you know, are battling this giant and have achieved a collective bargaining agreement despite and have achieved a level of consciousness and united struggle among workers in Belize, particularly as Black workers. It's just a tremendous achievement.
Thank you. We just wanted to remind our listening audience that we are speaking with our sister Pambana Basset, member of the Jamaica Peace Council. And so, Sister Pambana, can you talk to us about U.S.-backed roles in this struggle, particularly with Michael Ashcroft and William Bratton? Who are they, and why are they dangerous and a threat to Belizean stevedores?
So when it comes to the role of the U.S. in the struggle of the Black workers, the Black stevedores of Belize, there are just so many different pieces in which the U.S. and multinational interests are playing a role, as well as the U.K. Or Britain. And, you know, Belize gained independence in 1981 at a time of heightened U.S. interventionism across Central America and really the world, just a ferocious attack against grassroots, particularly Black and Indigenous movements, particularly socialist movements. And Belize gained independence from Britain and from white minority rule at that time. So it was a really kind of fraught independence in that sense, that, you know, both coming, you know, shaking off the chains of British imperialism while the U.S. was, encroaching upon their territories with real, tangible military threats and real corporate interests. And in the 80s, when neoliberalism was rearing its ugly head with great ferocity. So when it comes to specific U.S. interests, well, the port of Belize, located in Belize City, as I mentioned, is where all of these goods are brought in and out of the country, and where the majority, you know, it's the largest population in the city is in Belize. It used to be the capital before it was moved to Belmopan, with, I believe, largely around concerns of the sea level. You know, Belize City is very close to sea level. But also because, you know, this is, Belize City is, it remains, heart of Black, both African Creole as well as Garifuna, as well as Black immigrant population. And so the port brings in goods that are, you know, continue to be controlled by the U.S. and U.K. companies for the most part. So the port was privatized. And at this point is owned, in a complicated receivership by a company that's controlled by Michael Ashcroft, who's a large, I mean, he is a British, supposedly British Belizean Turks and Caicos national, who is out of the Conservative Party in the UK, who is a billionaire, who has, funded and bankrolled all kinds of right-wing initiatives across the so-called Commonwealth, you know, countries, territories that have fought against British imperialism. And in Belize, the amount of things and companies that he owns are obscene. You know, he's described as a philanthropist, so you will see all kinds of, you know, football fields, soccer fields named for him, as well as, you know, he's giving away, you know, his ill-gotten gains. And also, you know, he recently has acquired Scotiabank. He always plays a role in the electoral process in which Belize is currently engaged. And he also owns one of the major telecommunications corporations, one of the major hotels, and I'm sure many, many more businesses than I even know. He just is an immensely powerful political, corporate, right-wing conservative figure in Belize. And, you know, the empires always work in tandem. But in particular, when it comes to the U.S., many of the goods that come in and out of this privatized, Ashcroft-owned port are products, raw materials, that are being taken out of Belize to be refined in the so-called U.S., in occupied territories, the settler colony of Turtle Island. So, for example, American Sugar Refineries, based in Florida, is one of the main companies that controls sugar production in Belize, which is a large part of their agricultural export, as well as there's American Sugar Refineries, U.S. corporations that have stake in tourism, that have stake in various agricultural ventures. The fallen papaya industry, you know, is largely U.S. corporations moving to prey on countries like the Dominican Republic and exploit workers who, you know, are under administrations that have not been able to protect their workers' rights, or have not protect their workers' rights, you know, allying with the racist local elite. You know, so they would go to Dominican Republic, where the labor code has been weakened, and where they pay the workers much less. Anyway, so the U.S. has a really big political and economic interest in Belize as well, and particularly in the port. And then when it comes to the U.S.'s role in the region in terms of interventionism and just total militarization of the region, one has to remember that Belize borders Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras, with a maritime border, Honduras. And the U.S. has steadily just, you know, built all kinds of military, you know, bases or some kind of outpost in across Central America, and funded all kinds of illicit trade networks in roundabout ways and paramilitaries. As your listeners know, in 2009, the coup in Honduras brought a lot of armaments and really racist golpista coup violence against the people, including the Garifuna Nation, who currently are fighting and shouting for their five disappeared organizers, forcibly disappeared organizers. So in Belize has not been spared that hyper-militarization, and the people of the nation saw recently when the Port of Belize workers were on a protest or a demonstration, a show of action to defend their workers' rights during a lunch break, when the gang suppression unit fired tear gas on them and attacked the protesters, acting with complete and utter unconstitutionality and violence, for which the world has made really clear we, the workers, the poor, the students, the youth, the women, etc., are against this kind of state violence that has been bankrolled by the United States. And the gang suppression unit works largely with impunity. There are all kinds of whisperings about them being trained in Miami. At one point there was a deal that was being formed that the people, you know, protested against to be trained by Israel, as well as all kinds of support from the U.S. Embassy in Belize. And William Bratton, who your listeners may remember of the fame of you know, promoting heavily the broken windows policy and just horrid agendas against the homeless on Skid Row, etc. You know, he is pretty vehemently against Black Lives Matter and has been the commissioner of the NYPD, also, you know, of great fame of carrying out egregious acts of violence against our people in U.S. cities. And he is considered a consultant, or has done, you know, training of these multinational gatherings around supposed gang suppression and, policing initiatives that have ravaged communities with police who act with impunity, who target Black working class communities, and who are protecting the rich and the corporate. And so in the case of the Port of Belize, the gang suppression unit showed up and showed really clearly on whose side they stand.
Thank you so much, Sister Pambana Bassett with Jamaica Peace Council. And we were able to receive a message speaking on the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement, from the president of the Christian Workers Union, Evan Moshide.
The present CBA is not a perfect document, but its value comes from the length of time and the circumstances under which it was achieved. The collective agreement that was in place for stevedores when the port was privatized in 2004 was immediately nullified by the new owner, and essentially had the stevedores starting from square one, and they have had to inch their way ahead for every little bit of agreement that they've had over the 16 years. So they've had multiple memorandum of understandings which have been the bedrock of how it is they've gone about their profession. They have had multiple showdowns with the employer over the years. They have had to, in 2004 specifically, they had to break down the fence and block scabs that were trying to move containers while they were trying to negotiate an agreement. So it has not been an easy road. And so to finally have something in place when one understands that it didn't fall out the sky and it was no easy task for most of the members, it's a singular moment of tremendous value for them. But the circumstances under which they secure this agreement, the terms under which they put the employer in a position where they were given an ultimatum in the middle of the pandemic and forcing the government of the day, the present administration, to have to come out and essentially say that this was something that had to be done while the port and all its functions were basically in a shutdown mode because the stevedores would not work. And so it was over a four-day period, four days and nights, actually, when the final portions of the agreement were hammered out. The outcome of that is that the employer and its management culture and its worldview are in no mood to have any sense of, well, let us somehow let things calm down. So every day there is a constant supply of conflicts as the employer and the receivership move to try to single out individual members of our stevedore family that they deem to be the strength of the union and trying to find problems with them. And so we have been in multiple after CBA signing conflicts. We've had one of our members presently being terminated because of a broken glass, and that is something that we are challenging. That one is really a difficult one because they're attempting to use the CBA as it's presently constituted to address a matter that took place a significant time before the CBA was signed, and so we are objecting to that absolutely. And we find that because we are also at the union responsible for the sister unit at the port, that is the staff, and we have a very significant disagreement with the employer and the receivership, as they have terminated 36 of our members, and we have no doubt in our mind that it is a direct assault on the membership and a direct assault on the union. And so that matter is now going to be placed in front of the Labor Complaints Tribunal. Essentially, what I'm trying to portray or trying to sketch out for those who will hear this is that there's been no ceasefire, even though we've put in place a CBA. The union and the receivership slash employer have still not, and I don't know, I don't envision in the near future where it is we are going to be in a less than contentious atmosphere. I believe that the source and the mindset and the worldview of the people who have gotten their hands on this Port of Belize are going to have a scorched earth mentality to the rights of our members, to the rights of our stevedores, to a sense of any sense of justice and any sense of fairness. There is a scorched earth mentality to the rights of people to struggle for a living wage, to demand benefits that are appropriate for any human being. And so we don't envision that this battle is going to be over anytime soon, and so we are gearing up for that struggle because we have no intentions of surrendering a square inch. We believe that the struggle is critical for us to push back against a complete neoliberal invasion and essentially destruction of what we deem to be the last working class black haven that exists in our country. So we are standing as strong as we can stand. That is essentially where we are with them. Despite the fact we've signed the CBA, we value that it has been signed. We do understand that there is no ceasefire and we will have to stay on the front lines.
KPFK thanks you. Listener supporter.
Thank you. Thank you. I want that. Be right.
Volunteer.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road and back again.
For your continued support. And keeping this radio station powered by the people.
Thank you. I want that. Be right.
Membership is welcome at kpfk.org.
Let's do it again.
Hey, folks, this is General Jeff with the weekly Skid Row update. We still got thousands of people sleeping on the sidewalks, and it's just frustrating. And so appreciate the folks at Freedom Now to give us the opportunity to speak with you all and share the latest. So that you have the real-time information so that we as a people can hold these our elected officials accountable. This week, the city of Los Angeles opened up another shelter, this time right across the street from City Hall in City Hall East, called Fletcher Borum Square. The problem with that, though, is more importantly, they attached an enforcement zone to it. It's bridge housing shelter, and it's connected with all their bridge housing. is this enforcement zone, meaning they only allow homelessness inside of the shelter and not anywhere in the enforcement zone area. And this specific enforcement zone area is one of the largest expanded areas that we've known to date. So it goes all the way from the 101 freeway to the north. All street Skid Row starts to the south, and from Alameda Street all the way over to Broadway. And so it basically includes all of Little Tokyo. So not only does it include the area immediately adjacent to City Hall, where the Civic Building is called the Civic Center, they also include Little Tokyo. And so it's just ridiculous that because of this enforcement zone, the signage just went up a couple of days ago, that they will be enforcing and criminalizing folks even without proper notification. Over until they put some signs up on the street corners, there's no outreach, there's no, you know, notifications. So if people are homeless in that area, all of a sudden they could be targeted. You can't have your tents up. You know, it's just poorly done. It's in poor taste, disingenuous, and it's just the city's way to sneak and get people off the street. It's not fair. It's inhumane, and you know, and it's cheap and it's petty. And so, especially when you know there are enough of us well-respected activists, that the city could at least try to reach out with, or coordinate with. But that's the thing; they don't want to do it to where the people are, the homeless folks' rights are respected. And it's like they want to criminalize them, to arrest them, to get them off the streets. And that's ourselves reducing the homeless population on the streets. And it's just, you know, a bunch of hogwash. It's not cool at all. And so, you know, we want to share that out there, to pay attention to all these bridge housing that where they have the enforcement zones connected to. And it's not so much that they have the enforcement zone, where, of course, the folks that are anti-homeless will love the enforcement zones, because it's the excuse to justify, you know, basically arresting homeless folks. But when they open up shelter beds, like if there's going to be 50 shelter beds in an area, but then there are 500 homeless folks in the area, that means, you know, 50 people will get in the shelter and the other 450 will wind up being criminalized and taken into jail. That's not a solution to homelessness. And it's absolutely ridiculous for the city to roll out this and call it a solution. You know, so again, who do we blame for that? Obviously, city council signed off on it, but, you know, we got to look at Mayor Garcetti. You know, everything starts and stops with the mayor. You know, recently, last week, we talked about people in his staff that either are about to resign and or should resign. And we also want to note that with an upcoming election coming up in November, that if Biden wins, the Democratic nominee wins, there's strong consideration that Mayor Eric Garcetti will up and leave and go to get a cabinet position in Washington, D.C. And most likely it could be one of the options could be the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which sets a lot of the parameters for homelessness and issues out a lot of the funding, federal funding for homelessness. And so, you know, clearly a lot of these so-called solutions that Mayor Garcetti is pushing out there is to make his resume on paper look nice, clean, and pretty, like he's really doing something to address homelessness, when in fact he's just, you know, just sweeping homelessness under a rug so that the folks in Washington, D.C. have no idea what's really going on. And then, if the Democrats win in the White House, then he can, like, end up in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue with the Democratic nominee. So what then does that say about what happened to homelessness, the so-called solutions? What will happen with, you know, Measure HHH, and what will happen with all these false promises that Garcetti would just have abandoned us on? And so, you know, it's all about his first and his political career, and it's not even about really truly helping homeless people. And so now then we have to look at who would be the next, so you know, the next mayor in line. And, you know, then there's a whole bunch of new solutions, new people, new staff, the turnover. And in the meantime, homelessness is still piled up on the streets. So we look at homelessness, when we talk about real-time information, we want the Freedom Now listeners to know, us in Skid Row, not only currently, but we're also looking ahead, 2 and 3 steps ahead, like it's a chess game, because we have to stay in, on top of this, because we anticipate what the direction is going in. And right now, it's getting worse. There's nothing good in terms of, just like the stock market, when the analysts analyze the stock market, we're analyzing the homeless situation. It doesn't look good. Hopefully within maybe next week, we'll have some new answers or some better information to share with you. But this is General Jeff with your Skid Row Weekly Update. Stay tuned. Freedom Now. Peace.
It's that time of the Freedom Now Hour with our co-producer, prolific author, radical historian, professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, Dr. Gerald Horn. And so first, Dr. Horn, can you talk to us about systemic racism, the UN, and China?
Listeners may recall in June 2020, just months ago, Burkina Faso, in league with the African Union headquartered in Ethiopia, filed a resolution at the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, calling for a commission of inquiry into, quote, systemic racism, unquote, in the United States of America. This was obviously spurred by the on-camera lynching of George Floyd in Minneapolis and the ripples that it caused globally. This was also a throwback to 1950-1951 when Paul Robeson, in league with his comrade William Patterson, filed a similar petition at the United Nations charging genocide. That is to say, charging the United States with genocide against black people. That particular maneuver led directly to an agonizing retreat from the United States from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow or U.S. apartheid. Now, we know that Washington twisted arms in Geneva and the resolution did not take flight, but the struggle continues because, according to China Daily of July 9th, 2020, there was a virtual session on systemic U.S. racism in the United States sponsored by groups in Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, and China. There were 4,000 participants at this United Nations-affiliated session. The Venezuelan representative said that the United States was in flagrant violation against the Durban Plan of Action of 2001 that emerged, if you'll recall, from the United Nations-sponsored conference in South Africa focusing on racism some years ago. The Chinese representative urged Asian Americans to join hands with black Americans in fighting systemic racism in the United States of America. Now, there hangs a tale, because that noble recommendation would be easier to execute if China Daily itself stopped endorsing anti-affirmative action lawsuits filed by certain Asian American plaintiffs, particularly plaintiffs at Harvard and now Yale, that are designed to systematically oust black and brown youth from these august institutions. This is a particularly inopportune maneuver in light of the fact that China itself, I'm afraid to say, is under grave and dire threat. Kevin Rudd, the former Australian prime minister, said just days ago that as he sees it, there is a distinct possibility that the United States and China will be at war sooner rather than later. To punctuate that dire prediction, just days ago, United States jets buzzed Chinese military maneuvers in China itself. And as we speak, there are massive war games taking place in Hawaii, featuring the U.S. military and a number of close allies, including France, Japan, Australia, Canada, and South Korea, all targeting the People's Republic of China. I should also say, parenthetically, that these war games are being opposed by the people of Hawaii, not only because of the danger it presents to Hawaii itself in case there was an actual conflict, but also bringing all of these soldiers to this archipelago in the Pacific in some ways is bringing more opportunities for the coronavirus to spread. Now, what's even more striking is that the 45th U.S. President, Donald J. Trump, has launched a trade war against China, seeking to weaken its economy. He's even threatened to renege on paying back the billions, if not trillions, that the United States owes Beijing, because basically the People's Bank of China has been buying U.S. Treasury bills for years now, which are used to support everything from the post office to the Pentagon. Mr. Trump is also seeking to weaken major Chinese corporations like Huawei, that is a combination, that is to say, Huawei is a combination of both Apple and AT&T, and they're trying to deny Huawei microchips that they use to build computers and smartphones, and they've gone so far as to entice Canada to arrest the daughter of the founder of Huawei. Ironically enough, just a few weeks ago, China announced that it was calling for, quote, peaceful coexistence, unquote, with the United States of America. Now, I'm old enough to remember that when the Soviet Union called for peaceful coexistence in the 1960s and the 1970s with U.S. imperialism, China denounced that maneuver as a sellout, though the Soviet Union was then arming African liberation movements, and China itself was collaborating with South African apartheid and U.S. imperialism, especially in Angola in 1975. And I'm afraid to say China was at that time backed by many Black Americans in that escapade. Still, I think we must echo this call for peaceful coexistence between China and the United States. We must prove that Kevin Rudd is wrong when he suggests that war may erupt between China and the United States, not least because it would devastate Los Angeles, killing millions. But at the same time, we should ask our Chinese friends that it would be easier to accept their critique of systemic racism in the United States of America if they were to follow the long-term tradition in China of engaging in self-criticism of their past misdeeds that in some sense has brought planet Earth to the brink of destruction through war.
Thank you, Dr. Horn. And so next, we'd like to talk about what is happening domestically, particularly this past week's Republican National Convention and what's happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Those who have been paying attention to the Republican Convention broadcast virtually may recognize that it is a horror show. It's not even a figurative horror show. It might be literally a horror show, because we recall that Donald J. Trump Jr. referred to the man he called Beijing Biden as a monster. It's a horror show as well because the guest of honor has been the notorious McCloskey couple of St. Louis, Missouri, who you may recall just weeks ago were pictured waving weapons, waving guns at Black Lives Matter demonstrators marching past their palatial mansion in the city of St. Louis. Unsurprisingly, during this week of Republican Party shenanigans, Kenosha, Wisconsin has erupted, not only in the slaughter on camera once again of one Jacob Blake, but also this newest report that a young militia member, a Euro-American, took his weapon and killed two protesters protesting against the murderous attack on camera of Jacob Blake. What's even more remarkable about this Republican convention is that the Trump base, 63 million strong, are portraying themselves not as perpetrators, which they are, but as victims. This will, of course, allow them to justify their striking back at the real victims, for example, those who resemble Jacob Blake. I think that it is long past time to recognize that this Trump phenomenon, as represented in the Republican convention this week, basically represents the leading edge of a counter-revolution against anti-Jim Crow laws of the 1960s and social welfare measures of the 1930s, including Social Security and unemployment compensation, that is paving the way, intentionally or not, for a unique form of U.S. fascism that will emerge if we're not careful in the 21st century. Pay attention to what might be the vanguard of this movement. Speaking of QAnon, which has constructed a personality cult around Donald J. Trump, like Mussolini in fascist Italy in the first few decades of the 20th century, Donald Trump is portrayed as a strong man who is conducting a one-man war against the so-called deep state. The deep state, supposedly, believe it or not, according to QAnon, are comprised of cannibals, comprised of pedophiles. The deep state includes not only those in the State Department, but the media, Hollywood, etc. Recall that it was not so long ago that QAnon, which has been adjudged officially to be a terrorist group, was involved in the so-called Pizzagate scandal, where one of their deranged members attacked a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., because he thought that it was a center for child trafficking spearheaded by the Democrats, including Hillary Rodham Clinton. Now, despite the bizarre nature of QAnon, it has been embraced by Donald J. Trump. In some ways, QAnon is also a throwback to the 1500s, because QAnon is also fervently Islamophobic. They have made a particular game, I'm afraid to say, of targeting Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, one of the few Muslims in the U.S. Congress. Also, akin to 1930s fascists, QAnon also dabbles in the occult. Recall that when you had the eruption of the so-called plague of the 1300s, it paved the way for the rise of pogroms and bigoted attacks against minorities. With the disruptive impact of the coronavirus and COVID-19, we have to make sure that this history is not repeated, and that 2020 and the 21st century will not be a repeat of the 1300s, paving the way for more Kenosha-type shootings. We also know that the Republican Party plans to prevail in November with voter suppression and intimidation, particularly in Wisconsin. And we also know that QAnon is seen as the vanguard of this illegitimate movement, which brings me to one of the more heartening developments in recent weeks. Speaking of the Wildcat strike engineered by professional basketball players, which has quickly spread from the Milwaukee Bucks to Major League Baseball and the Women's Basketball League, and even Naomi Osaka, the Haitian Japanese tennis star, has dropped out of a tennis match because she claims she's totally disgusted with what she called, quote, genocide, unquote, against black people, referring to the slaying of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. So that is a positive signal that leads us to hope and believe that we can beat back this fascist attack.
And so as we get ready to wrap up here at Freedom Now, Dr. Horn, can you talk to us about warmonger Mike Pompeo and what he's doing in Jerusalem and Sudan?
Another part of the horror show of the Republican convention, broadcast virtually, is the fact that Secretary of State Michael Pompeo violated norms by giving a convention speech from Jerusalem in Israel, which not only violated norms, but may have been against the law. After giving that speech, he jetted to the Sudan and pressured the new regime to recognize Israel and to pay $300 million in damage claims to U.S. litigants who, it is said, had family members that were killed in the attacks on U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya some years ago that were said to involve Sudanese complicity. Now, fortunately, the new regime in Sudan was wise enough to say that they have no mandate to recognize Israel, which I don't feel Mr. Pompeo found to be satisfactory, but certainly it would have caused upset in the streets of Sudan if the Sudanese government had taken that particular bait and recognized Israel. It would have caused substantial unrest, which is already bubbling over in the neighborhood. On Freedom Now, we brought attention to the conflict between Sudan's neighbors, speaking of Egypt and Ethiopia, concerning the Nile River and a dam that Ethiopia is building with regard to that particular artery that Egypt describes as its lifeblood. We all know that another neighbor of Sudan, speaking of Libya, is enmeshed in conflict. On the one hand, you have France and Egypt backing one faction and Turkey backing another. We also have discussed on Freedom Now another outgrowth of the disastrous and catastrophic 2011 war on Libya, that is to say, the leakage of tons of weapons from Libya into neighboring Mali that fueled the religious insurgency that of late has led to the toppling of the government in Bamako and the taking over of that government by soldiers, by the way, who happen to be trained in the United States of America. And we also know that there are U.S. forces on the ground in Mali, along with thousands of French troops. Similarly, speaking of this conflict between France and Turkey and Libya, it's also extended to the Eastern Mediterranean, where there have been actual confrontations between French vessels and Turkish vessels because of conflicts over Turkey claiming waters territorially that are said to contain natural gas, and Turkey's longtime antagonist, speaking of Greece, contests this Turkish claim backed by France. Now, what's even more remarkable is that if this neighborhood goes up in flames, it can be said to have been a direct outgrowth of the Libyan debacle of 2011, which, as noted, has brought Turkey, Egypt, and France into conflict with consequences too enormous to contemplate at this moment. This has been Gerald Horn for Freedom Now.
And in closing, we'd like to thank our guests, Sister Pambana Bassett, Brother Mose Hyde, our Sister Luyana Kuboka, Sister Femi, Dr. Gerald Horn, Brother General Jeff, and all those who made today's program possible. Thank you to our board op, Ricky. Please stay tuned for Sister Sumta coming up next with Spotlight Africa. This program can be reheard for the next 60 days. You can go to kpfk.org, audio archives, scroll to Freedom Now. This has been Sister Thage, and until next week, as always, we stand ready for revolution.
If you would like to support your favorite radio station, KPFK, please consider donating your vehicle to us, whether it's operational or not, because your donation helps KPFK as well as present you with an opportunity to write it off of your taxes. And if you would like to donate and get more information,